Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Equity Guru podcast. I'm talking to Tim McCutcheon from Ashanti Gold. Its ticker symbol is AGZ on the Venture Exchange. Tim, your stock price has taken a bit of a rocket over the last couple of days. You've got a lot of things going on. But for somebody who's no idea of what Ashanti is and what it does, can you talk me through the very basics?
Yeah, sure. And glad to be here. Ashanti Gold was set up as a vehicle to really take advantage of a certain sort of empty niche, if you will, in the market. By background, I'm an investment banker, and any investment banker would tell you you're sort of looking for places where the market might not be totally efficient and where you have a competitive advantage. And Ashanti was set up because, as many of your listeners might know, basically from around 2012 to about a year ago, the financing that was available for junior mining companies really dried up. And it was a really horrible time for those of us in the industry for about 3-4 years. And then it opened up again, as it tends to do. These things move in waves. And what was clear was that in Western Africa, there is, you know, by just the geology and you know, science, there's a lot of gold there. And pretty much all of the senior gold miners are in West Africa right now, and they're quite active there. However, in this dry spell that I mentioned between, you know, 2012 for 3-4 years, all of the junior mining companies that were really involved in proving up the next round of projects, if you will, that, you know, normally sort of get developed by the seniors or the juniors become seniors themselves, they all died off because there wasn't any funding for them. There wasn't any funding that was available in the normal course of, you know, the capital markets. And so what I saw was, you know, you had, if you did a list of all the companies involved in Western Africa in gold development in 2012 and you tracked them, you know, 4 years since then, you'd find that about 80% of them are gone. They're dead. They've become tech companies or they've simply, you know, been liquidated. Right. And about 10% of those were bought out by the seniors and about 10% are left. And pretty much over and over again, what's been happening is the ones that are left are getting bought out. And in fact, just a couple weeks ago, a company called Avnel was bought out by Endeavor. And that's one less company, you know, independent company active in the region. So what all of that means is that from a top-down point of view, you know, 3 to 3-4 years from now, when all these seniors are looking for the next project or resource replacement, there's nothing for them to buy. And so Ashanti was, you know, looking at that top-down situation. And, of course, bottom-up, it's all about, you know, what do I know that other people don't know, right? And the competitive advantage that the team had that I put together was – we used to run Kinross's joint venture for exploration in Ghana. So we had a huge database from doing that. Paul Clifell, who's my COO, and myself, we used to run a company that was the joint venture partner with Kinross in Ghana for exploration. And this was in 2012, 2013. So we had a huge database, and it turns out it's sort of a long story, but the short story is that we had an opportunity to basically cherry-pick the best assets out of that portfolio from Kinross, which is what we did, and those are now the Ashanti Belt projects in our portfolio. And then the other sort of bottom-up thing is, you know, I've been an investment banker for a long time. Most of the time was in Europe. The liquidity that we talked about, right, with 2012 and everything else, that really hasn't hit London yet. So you have a whole bunch of similar companies to Canada, you know, involved in junior mining, and there's basically no money available for them at all. And so you have a lot of junior mining companies active in West Africa with very competent teams who have done a lot of really good work, and yet they can't raise any money. And by virtue of my background, I know these people, and I know them quite well. And so I was able to, again, cherry-pick a couple of assets that really have, you know, strong potential, and a lot of the risk has already been removed, but I've been able to pick them up on an earn-in basis only, which means that, you know, Ashanti hasn't paid any money into someone else's pocket. All of the money that we spend and we raise on the capital markets goes into adding value by, you know, putting it in the ground. And that's the key thing too, right? Because, you know, what people are tired of in the Canadian markets is just, you know, people paper shuffling back and forth, trading assets back and forth, and nothing actually gets done. So, you know, the whole Ashanti story is really, it's built for the investor. It's built for, you know, the capital markets, which the whole idea is that there's a niche that needs to be filled. And, you know, as I'm an investor myself, I'm one of the largest investors in Ashanti, but also I've just been an investor in the junior mining space for many, many years. And what you like to see in these companies is you like to see teams of people that are dedicated to get things done as opposed to shuffling paper around.
So when you say you cherry picked these properties, I don't think you could be any more accurate in your definitions. It seems to me that in a hot resource market, the pieces that you've got are worth a lot of money, and it's just really it's down to the fact that although the resource sector has been picking up of late, it's still been very focused around North America and around lithium. It hasn't really sort of hit full stride yet. So you've got in very early on some really primo pieces.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that I like to look at is, remember we talked about the 80% are dead and 10% are not. So the comparables in my space that are still around, and there aren't that many, but there are a few, if you kind of look at the benchmark that I'm going to, if you have a company, a public company involved in West African gold development and exploration, and if there's visibility to having a viable project, you don't necessarily have to have the viable project, you have to have visibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's not necessarily mathematically laid out, but that it's clear that, you know, someone takes the time to kind of look at it. So yeah, this, you know, this can work. The minimum benchmark for a company like that is about $30 million in terms of valuation. That's what the market's paying. And that goes all the way up to, you know, about 150 or so. So you have companies like Orezone, West African Resources, even a company like Pinecrest, for example. Mm-hmm. These are all companies on the Toronto Stock Exchange. They're all active in the region, and they all have this viable sort of concept that I'm talking about. That's my peer group. So, you know, basically, if we're simply to converge, to basically close the gap with the lowest benchmark tier, that's double our current market cap right now.
Mm-hmm. And that market cap right now is already up around half just in the last week over what it was several days ago.
Yeah, and I was recently marketing this to some portfolio investors and to some high net worth individuals, and that was the one thing that really resonated, right? Was just sort of telling people, like, look, you know, if you just put us into a comparable spreadsheet and you do the math and you kind of look at my peer group, you know, even if we close the gap with the absolute lowest part of our peer group, we're still, you know, we're three times higher than we are right now. And this is a week ago before the big run-up that we've had recently. But the point is that people – it's so obvious that that's why we've had this run-up in the past week or so.
Let's – I mean, usually resource investing is a case of trying to knock off the risk factors in a project. So let's roll through the traditional risk factors here and tell me how Ashanti stacks up. West Africa, working in West Africa – for a company that's based out of a Bay Street or a House Street office, not always easy. Where do you sit on the getting your hands dirty side?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's a couple of things. One is to be very cognizant of the fact that we are in Vancouver and things are over there. So, you know, we're not claiming to I have inside because I know the president's brother or something like that.
Okay.
A lot of people tend to do that and they delude themselves into thinking things. Look, it's really simple. I mean, we have earn-in agreements with other companies that have a presence in these countries.
Mm-hmm.
And we are piggybacking on their existing infrastructure and their existing relationships. And we've made them our own relationships. So what that means is that there's a certain safety valve in terms of simply knowing who to call to get things done and to file paperwork and everything else. You know, certainly by virtue of the fact that Paul and I used to run the joint venture with Kinross means that, you know, we land in the airport in Accra in Ghana and we know where to go. We know, you know, how to tell the cab driver to get to the hotel,
right.
And we know what things cost. And so, you know, we're not going to get ripped off on the train station kind of thing.
And when you're trying to get mining permits resumed on properties, you don't have any struggles of figuring out where to go and what to do.
Exactly. I mean, because I've done it in the past, right?
Yeah.
So the learning, you know, one of the key things, again, we talked about, you know, this is an investment banker sort of company, is that shareholders are not going to pay for our learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've already gone through it all, right? So that's the other thing. And the key thing about West Africa, I mean, I think people get really confused about the nature of political risk and what it really means. I mean, you know, Ghana is a very stable country. It's probably the most stable country in Africa as a whole right now. English law, a strong tradition of, you know, having regular presidential elections and transfer of power from different parties and so on. So I feel that's fine. Mali has had a little bit of a bumpier ride. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, if you really kind of look at what the things that have happened in West Africa, in terms of political unrest and whatnot, is that it's basically not ideological, which more or less means that, you know, if there is an internal power struggle, and I'll be the first to admit that, you know, that's way above my pay grade in terms of where we operate in these countries. But if there is a political struggle and everything else, at the end of the day, it's an internal affair between competing political groups in those countries. It's not an ideological thing, right? So your tax regime, you know, the body of law that is there, it pretty much stays the same regardless of who's running the show.
Got it. So you don't have a new president suddenly have a bunch of family members coming down with guys.
Well, right, because they're not like, okay, all of a sudden now we're against mining. Like, no.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that doesn't happen. It's really just like, okay, the new minister is my cousin and not the old cousin of the old minister kind of thing.
Right.
Those issues aren't they don't affect the medium, the long-term viability of projects. And again, if you notice over and over again, you know, there was a little bit of unrest in Cote d'Ivoire, and 6 months it was a little unclear. And then now it's, you know, one of the bright stars of West Africa in terms of economic growth and reform and everything else. Burkina Faso is the same way. Again, you know, look, it's not Canada. But it's risk and reward. I mean, I don't think we would have the chance of picking up the projects we did if they were in, you know, British Columbia or Yukon,
sure.
Right? Because
sure.
It wouldn't be available.
There's often, you know, in a bull market, there's often guys that will run off to, you know, developing world countries and claim that they've found nice big untapped bits of ground. But definitely Ghana has a tradition precious metals coming out of the ground there. And clearly the country is enjoying the economic benefits of that. So I guess the chances of someone coming in and deciding to screw with the nature of things is pretty remote.
Yeah. Again, you know, it's not ideologically based, right? It's all about, it's like there's the country, there are certain circles of influence and people and capital that are in all of these countries. It is, you know, I certainly do my best to keep my eye on what's going on,
mm-hmm.
but the reality is that I have very little influence on any of those events, if any. So, you know, the best you can do is you can observe, you can take note, and you can be prepared to the extent that you can in case things change. But again, I do think that there's, in North America in particular, we have a very odd notion of political risk and sort of what exactly that means.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that, you know, no matter who's running the show, they're going to want, you know, people, foreigners bringing money into the country, bringing investment into the country, and eventually providing jobs and you know, basically helping local communities. And that's the same regardless of the political makeup of any of these countries.
Certainly,
and that's panned out time and time again.
Certainly anyone who's looking to get a pipeline through BC or an LNG terminal built is having a much tougher political time than somebody who's looking to renew a mining.
Oh, I mean, I can go on forever about how Canada's low political risk and there's this whole litany of companies that have basically had their projects squashed in a quote-unquote low-risk environment. So yes, I mean, I think that's a fair comment to make.
I think what's impressive about where Ashanti is sort of steering in this direction is how difficult it's been to get you actually on the phone over the last month, because you're constantly on a plane to Ghana or on a plane to Mali, and I know in your background you spent time in Russia, so certainly you're not somebody who's going to look at the agenda and say, maybe I can just send my assistant down this trip.
And
you seem to be a guy who likes to get out there and roll the mattress out onto the dirt floor.
Well, I mean, look, you know, I used to be an equity analyst, and I was a top-ranked analyst for EMEA when I lived and worked in Europe. And, you know, frankly, the decision to leave investment banking analysis was simply that I got tired of watching other people do things and commenting on it. I wanted to be the doer. And that really is true. I mean, Ashanti Gold is not a lifestyle company. And I think your viewers, you know, as they learn more about capital markets and read the, you know, the filings and reports of various companies, what they're going to see is they're going to see, you know, executives getting paid way in excess of what, you know, that company size can possibly bear. Mm-hmm. You're going to see people, you know, where their headquarters is in, you know, not in Vancouver, it's in, you know, Kelowna or it's
right.
in Palm Beach, right? And you're kind of thinking, you know, you know what's going on, right? It's a project attached to some guy's lifestyle. And Ashanti is not that. I mean, we are, the management team is collectively, especially now the second largest shareholder of the company, but we're all motivated by equity capital appreciation. I mean, that's how we're going to do well. We enjoy building companies, we enjoy doing it, but we're not doing this for our health, right? We're doing this to basically add value and to make money for shareholders and everyone else. I mean, when you buy a stock in Ashanti Gold, you're in the same basket as I am and everyone else on the team is. So you're at, you know, the end point of value is the same for everyone. And that's important, right? Because what we're just trying to do is just drive this thing forward and not waste time. Just get things done.
It's interesting to me. One of the other risk factors often in, on the resource side is companies that have too much going on and you know, lack the focus to get one project really moved forward. Sometimes people might call them prospect generators. Are you a prospect generator? Or is the fact that you've got three projects down to the fact that you saw three real good opportunities?
Yeah, no. The prospect, I mean, let me put it this way. Take a look at a traditional prospect generator and look at their share price over the past 10 years that they've been around that long. I mean, you know, if you're trading volatility, you might make a little money, but otherwise they don't really go anywhere. I think one of the key things about Ashanti is that the projects that we picked up, the ones from the London listed companies, the one Kasanto in Mali and Anumso in Ghana, they have already had millions of dollars spent on them in the past. But it was done in a London context, which means that, you know, all of the numbers and all of that data, which obviously was very exciting because we wouldn't have picked them up if it wasn't, none of that has ever really been released in a Canadian market context, right? So it's kind of lost. On a Kasanto, the previous vendor spent $5 million on it, and prior to that, a couple other $1 million were spent on the vendor before him. The same thing with Anumso in Ghana. So they are much more de-risked than I think the market understands. And they are not prospect generated. I mean, they have already been generated, the prospect. It's simply a case of an underlying company that owns it can no longer raise money in the current form that it's in. It's in the wrong box, right?
No,
it doesn't have, you know, either the management doesn't have the time nor the skill nor simply just the contacts to get investor eyeballs on this thing to tell the story and to make people understand why it has merit. Bringing these projects over to the Canadian market with a new set of expertise that we have and basically, you know, showing the market very clearly that, look, we're going to do this to this project and this is what potentially is going to be, and then demonstrating that the risk is really removed, that's a very powerful thing, and that's our added value, and that's sort of the whole point, is that they're much lower risk than I think people really appreciate.
So these projects, by the nature of the fact that they came from European originators, they have the JRC historic resources attached. Does this give you a bit of a obviously you have to switch these over to a 43-101, but it gives you a bit of an insight into exactly what's there. Although, you know, those estimates aren't IROC ready, but they're still legitimate estimates. That give
well,
you
I mean, you know, it's ironic that Canada is the only market that doesn't use JORC. The rest of the world does, except Canada.
Sure.
So, look, in terms of the robustness of a JORC resource, in terms of the statistical veracity and the methodology behind it, it is just as good as NI 43-101.
Right.
There's just no, you know, I don't care what anyone tells you. It's just, you know, there's some other resource standards out there that maybe aren't, but JORC certainly is.
Yep.
So it's really not an issue. But the Canadian regulators won't let me use it.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. The point, though, is that those reports are available. You know, if you look at the last press release we came out with, there's a link to the underlying vendor's website, and if you poke there, you're going to find the resource report, and you can read it. And the same thing with the report on ANUMSO. You know, we basically wrote an I-43-101 report on ANUMSO. It's on our website, where we have documented all the historical work that was done in the past. And again, if you just read it, you'll say, like, holy cow, this thing has been massively de-risked. But, you know, there are limits to what we can do because exactly what you said, IROC's going to basically jump down our throat if we start throwing out numbers that aren't compliant with Canadian regulations. So, you know, a little bit of homework, and that's really, you know, for your listeners, that's the arbitrage opportunity field. It's an information arbitrage. If you do a little bit of homework and read this stuff, what you're going to say is, wow, there's a whole lot of data here and a whole lot of work has been done that is not and cannot be released in the Canadian context, even though it's perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm. It really sort of comes back to that sort of money ball approach that I think that you're taking, which is, you know, using the information that's out there that most people have overlooked or haven't yet got around to. And as you say, information arbitraging that situation, finding that inefficiency in the market and capitalizing on it.
Yeah, it's a great analogy. I like that. Good movie.
It's a great movie. It's a really good book, too. The fact that you're in Africa, a lot of people will steer clear. It's too hard for them. They don't understand the surroundings. The fact that you're in gold, which, you know, is starting to make noises but hasn't really done the big crash yet, the big run-up yet.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of early stage, you know, crest of the wave, sort of low risk, low financial input work that you've done here that you know, a year down the line, I could see potentially really paying off in a big way, or at the very least, finding its true worth, which I don't think it has yet.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I'll be the first to admit that the Ashanti Gold is not the investment for everyone, and it certainly shouldn't be. You know, it's part of a portfolio of assets if that's what you want to do. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, it's about, you know, the way you make money and this sort of thing is you get leverage to an underlying story, and then you have to study the story to make sure that it makes sense. And if it does, you want to get leverage in, because if you're in for a dollar, you might as well be in for 10, kind of thing.
Yeah, sure.
So you want to get leverage to that story. If someone says, oh, you know, I'm not comfortable with Africa, it's too risky for me, that's fine, except that, you know, you got to understand that you're going to be paying, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5 times more for the same type of asset in a jurisdiction that you might be more comfortable with.
Sure.
So, you know, I've always sort of been of the opinion is that if you're investing in the junior mining space, you're already taking on a massive amount of leverage just conceptually, right? Because that's the nature of the junior mining business. And so if you're going to take on the leverage, don't fool yourself. you might as well embrace it as opposed to being shying away from it. Because, you know, the mining business is an inherently risky business. And because it's an inherently risky business, you have to appreciate that when you're going in. I mean, it's not buying an energy utility, right?
Yeah.
It's not. And so if you you know, any sort of investment is about expectations, right? You're investing based on a certain expectation. And I think a lot of people have their expectations out of whack with what it is to actually put their money in.
Yeah. I heard it said recently that most investing is red or black, but that mining investing is I'll put everything on 3. Or 32, you know.
Well, right. But then the whole point, though, is that if you're going to try to get something that's like really, you know, a cheap stock with massive upside, blah, 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 with a property in the Yukon, I can guarantee you, if you actually look at the work that was done on the property, at best it might be, you know, a mapping expedition.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're going to, you know, so you're better off going to the casino, frankly, with those odds.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the whole point with Ashanti is that someone else has already done all of that work, millions upon millions of dollars of drilling, trenching, mapping, geophysics, metallurgical work. All of that has been done on our projects that, you know, the replacement cost alone of that work is higher than our market cap.
I like the fact that the work that's been done today, or the money that you've raised today, it really is being plowed into the ground. Like you wanted to finish the due diligence and confirm historic information on those properties, and you've done that. There's many pictures on your website and your presentation of you know, activity on the ground, as opposed to the conceptual work that sometimes is done, you know, where we'll fly a helicopter and we'll wait 6 months till we really look at the information.
Yeah, I mean, you're invested anytime, and if one of your investor audiences, you look at a gold mining company, a mining company. They have pictures of beautiful mountains with snow-capped peaks. I was like, you should avoid that company like the plague, because all, that means it's more expensive, right? I mean, you want a mining company that's like in the middle of a very flat plain with nice big highways going straight to your resource.
And there's lots of other big companies around that have been successfully producing a lot of rock. All of your projects here are very, very close to someone else.
That's right. I mean, you don't want to be romantic. You want to be, you know, so we have our projects in Ghana literally are adjacent to one of the world's largest gold mines. They actually abut both to the south and to the north, one of the world's largest gold mines run and owned and operated by Newmont. Mm-hmm. Our project in Mali, you know, literally adjacent to our property to the left of us is Randgold, which is one of the biggest gold miners in the world and very active in Africa. To our to the right of us, to the east of us, is Acacia, which is spin out from Barrick Gold, and their property, again, is adjacent to our property. And then within a 40-kilometer radius of where we are, there are no less than six gold deposits, all of which are more than 3 million ounces of gold.
That's a lot of gold.
I mean, the place is just, you know, it's crawling with gold, right? So that's mm-hmm. fantastic. And all the people who matter, who are smart, are there. And so we're, you know, basically going full in as far as we can. And so, again, you know, you don't want to invest in romanticism. You want to invest on cold, hard, you know, logic, which is, you know, if we're right next to very smart companies with lots of money and they're drilling and we're right next to them and we're drilling and the geology is the same, then there's a pretty good chance that we're going to find the same stuff.
Even if one of your projects blanks out, mathematically, I would find it insane to think that at least one of your projects isn't going to find something similar to what's next to it, and also be a big buyout target as soon as those results start showing themselves.
Well, that's right. I mean, Kansanto in Mali has potential to be a multi-million ounce deposit. That's the potential there. The rocks are very similar to everything else around us that is already a multi-million ounce deposit. So, you know, again, this is very de-risked. If you talk about in Ghana, you know, the properties that we optioned off of Kinross actually used to be part of Newmont's land package that they basically got rid of before they knew they had one of the world's largest gold deposits. All of the geology on the Newmont property extends off onto our properties. So, you know, same rock, same area, so there's a pretty good chance that it's the same stuff.
And the historic estimates are already sort of sitting around there just gathering dust.
That's right. That's right. So it's information arbitrage, right?
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's knowing things other people don't know, because you either do your homework or you just get lucky. And I got lucky with Kinross because I used to run their exploration JV. So I had all the data.
Yeah, remember that.
Yeah.
So tell me, what stopped those companies from looking at their own information and doing exactly what you've done, just going in there and picking it up and finishing the paperwork? And is it just the fact that a lot of those large companies don't know what's in the desk drawers?
Well, when it comes to the Kinross properties, that's exactly the answer. And as counterintuitive as that may seem, it's actually very true. A lot of the big companies, you know, there's so much data and they're operating in so many jurisdictions and there's been so much M&A activity over the, you know, the decades that they've been around, that they simply don't know where information is. And particularly because in Africa, you know, a lot of this stuff is scan paper. I mean, you can't even do a search for a key term or anything because it's some scanned page that's been typed up, right?
Wow.
So it's just data management. And they know it. I mean, they're aware of that. They know that. And the other thing is that they would rather have someone like me prove up an asset and then they'll pay a massive premium, but at least, you know,
the wheels keep turning.
It'll be completely de-risked and they can present it to their board and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
So they don't really do exploration development. They basically buy out turnkey projects.
I'm guessing they see a pretty steady flow of guys like you who are on the payroll deciding that they've got opportunities elsewhere and then suddenly showing up next door.
Yeah, you know, and then in the case of the London things, just to be totally clear, I mean, the issue with them is, you know, any businessman in this business has a certain investor audience that they can go to based on their track record and everything else. They build up their track record. And, you know, this business is about raising. I mean, it from a cash flow point of view, it's cash that goes out, right? It's a one-way street. We raise money through selling equity, and then we spend the cash, and you're playing capital appreciation, right? You're basically saying that for every dollar we raise on the capital markets, we're going to create $5 worth of value because we're going to drill it out, you know, because we know things other people don't know. So you have an investor audience, and for the people in London, that investor audience doesn't have any money.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and you know, it's just management. Sometimes you get stuck in a situation where you don't have enough money to get new eyeballs on it because that costs money too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the guys in London, you know, if they had a little extra money, yeah, I'm sure they could do a few road shows in the U.S., do a few road shows in Canada, and maybe get, you know, someone to open up their checkbook. But they're way past that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
They just, they can't do it. So, again, it's just a lot of times you'll see projects in the wrong box.
And so going back to the eliminating risk side of thing, a lot of times you see mining projects or mining companies where the guys that are involved used to be an IR or they were loosely affiliated with someone else, and this is their big CEO jump.
Right.
You got some people around you that have some serious chops, do you know?
Yeah. I mean, that was, again, this is part of this create, you know, like I said, this has been specifically designed to do a certain thing, right? It's not sort of an accident. So as far as myself, I sat on every side of the table in the banking business world. So I've been an investment analyst. I've been an investment banker. I've been a fund manager. So I finance things like Ashanti. I've run things like Ashanti before. I've analyzed things like Ashanti before. And I've done deals with things like Ashanti before. So I've done every single side of the table with this, and I know what each side is thinking, so I know how to address those concerns. Paul Klipfel is the COO. He's got an amazing resume. I mean, the key thing that I think is he used to be part of the generative team for a company called Placerdome that was bought out by Barrick. He asked anyone who's been on the mining business for a while about the Placerdome, you know, geology team, and they'll tell you it was the best in the business. And so he was one of the stars there before it got bought out by Barrick. And since then, he's a really practical guy. He's a geologist from the point of view, he's a very academic geologist. He's a doctorate in geology. He has a doctorate in geology. But he doesn't give me the history of dinosaurs rap, which I can't stand, right? I mean, like, look, you know,
with
Paul, I never have to tell Paul, like, we're in this to make money. He's like, he knows. I don't care about the whatever thing. He's like, no, is there gold there or not? And can we get the gold out of the ground? So he understands why it is what we do, and that's very important. CFO and CEO are people, CFO and corporate secretary are people that I worked with in the past. I trust them 100%. They're very competent in what they do. In terms of the board, you know, these are people who are really top tier people. So Jonathan Henry, is the CEO of a company called Gabriel Resources, which owns and operates the largest gold deposit, in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to basically get it permitted so they can build a mine. Before that, he used to run a company called Avocet Mining, which was a 500,000-ounce-a-year producer. It was a big mining company, close to a $1 billion market cap company. And he used to run that for many, many years. So that's Jonathan Henry. Grant Sinisen, was one of the top managers for a company of Fleming family, one of the oldest banking families in the world. He was top manager for their Russian office. He's a Vancouver boy, but I met him in Moscow. And he put together a company called Highland Gold, which is now a $500 million company listed in London, that produces about 400,000 ounces of gold a year. And he did that. He built that project from the ground up. So, you know, these are two guys where they have a lot of eyeballs. You know, they can bring a lot of eyeballs to look at Ashanti, and we can basically get into the door with them in a way that you can't really with other people. And then on the advisory board, we have Hank Van Alphen, who has just been a serial entrepreneur in Vancouver and put together
he's a legend,
and he's been extremely successful at identifying opportunities, making sure the capital markets is behind him for the long haul, and that's very important for us. And so he has a reputation he brings with him, again, to bring eyeballs on the company.
He just lit it up with Wealth Minerals down in South America as well.
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's right. You know, and I'm helping him out on that project as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's taken it was the third best performing company on the Toronto TSXV stock exchange last year.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think if it went up 800%, I forget what the number is, but
not a
lot. Yeah. And then the other guy we have is Bill Pincus, who I worked with in the past, and he's just an incredibly well-respected geologist. He sold Esperanza to Alamos at a time when no one was selling any companies. This is 2000 and I forget when it was. I think it was 2009. You know, basically the absolute horrible time he managed to – he had such a good project and he was such a competent person that he was able to sell – a gold developer to Alamos, which is now one of the largest gold miners in the world. So he's also on the board, the advisory board as well. And so, you know, again, there's no fluff here. There's no extraneous people. There's no executive that's got to get paid out and contracts or whatever. All of that's been cleaned up. The company's clean as a whistle.
You got a nice share structure as well. So there's room there if you ever needed to raise money.
That's right. You know, there's a clean share structure. It's not a big share count. You can pretty much count. I mean, you could count on two hands the shareholders that collectively probably own like 80% of the company. So you know, you're never going to wake up in the morning and see someone just puke out a huge block of shares because there's nothing like that in the shareholder structure.
Right.
Which is great, right? I mean, everyone's here for a reason and a purpose. Everyone is specifically designed to be there. They want to be there, and so it's exactly, you know, where I want to be.
Well, it's somewhere where I want to be as well. I've taken a piece out of your most recent private placement, and I'm happy to do so. We're looking at the share action so far. But I think what's really interesting about your company is that all the usual red flags, you know, everyone has like one blind spot, one thing that they have to fix. And I look through what you've put together, and I don't see the thing you have to fix. I just see a process where you move forward, you know, methodically, you do your thing, you update the paperwork on these projects that, you know, would have been surging along if the resource sector hadn't crapped itself a couple of times over the last few years. And the really important thing is when I talk to other people in the business about the various companies that are out there, anytime I've mentioned a shanty, like people take that tone of, this is a serious company. This isn't a Vancouver company. It's not a, you know, a dice roll. This is a serious business that's being put together in a serious way by serious people, which is a real differentiator in the resource space out of Vancouver.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I think I said it before, but I'll say it again. I mean, this is not a lifestyle company. We're in here to you know, not waste time, do our job, and, you know, all the equity holders of Ashanti, we're all in the same boat, and we're all trying to see that share price go higher.
It's in a world where Mr. Putin is taking a bigger picture, a bigger piece of the picture. Any thoughts about going back to Russia one day? And
it's obviously a bigger comment than maybe this phone call, but. All I can say, I mean, I lived there for almost 20 years, I can pretty much everything you read in the press here is either a distortion of the truth or just wrong. And it has nothing to do with whether or not you like Trump or don't like Trump. I could care less. The point is that, you know, the country has been massively misrepresented in the Western media to the point where it's just, you know, it's just silly. I mean, Moscow is an incredibly exciting, wealthy place, and I was just there 3 weeks ago. No one's starving. And the joke was, how did you know who was a foreigner on Red Square in the 1990s? It was the guy who was best dressed. And how did you know there was a foreigner on Red Square? And, you know, now it's the guy who's worst dressed. And it's just, that's true. It's absolutely true. So
if an opportunity arose in Russia, where obviously a lot of people would think twice, but you'd be happy to jump up in with both feet.
Well, again, absolutely. It's perception of political risk as opposed to actual political risk. And, you know, I used to have really strange conversations with investors. Oh, it's risky. And then, you know, you have a guy from the Congo where they literally have armed guards outside of their mine sites, like, you know, shooting people. No, it's fine. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. So again, it's a conversation. I'm obviously, you know, it's a very deep conversation, but at the end of the day, all I can say is that, you know, the world looks a lot different when you're on the receiving end of U.S. foreign policy.
Even in Canada, I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah. So.
Well, man, this is it's been a great conversation, and you know, congratulations on moving Ashanti to where it is. It's I feel like in terms of the usual risk, I think that you've done a really good job on shining this thing up nicely. And certainly, what do you see for the next 6 months as being your primary focus?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, you know, what we're doing, we have a soil sample program on them. So we're paying off laboratory bills right now as we speak to get those results back and put them together. We have met test work on them, so metallurgical testing, so we can determine the best way to recover the gold from our property, from the UNUMSO property. So those results will be coming out in the next 1 to 2 months. The big thing, of course, is the drilling results in Kasanta. We just finished up a drilling program last month. All of those are sent to the laboratory, and you know, we get those back and we analyze those, and we'll come out with those in short order. But again, if you look at the historical data, we have every reason to think that the new data is going to be the same as the old data, and the old data is spectacular. So that's, you know, a pretty exciting benchmark for us. Putting together the whole Kinross properties to work with Newmont, because Newmont's mine, that's our neighbor, is essentially running out of ore, and they need the material that we're likely to find on the Kinross properties. And so I've been talking with them, so we can basically put two earn-ins back to back and not have to spend any money and just clip it for essentially for a royalty on the inside. So that would be a great sort of, and that's in our presentation on our website. You can take a look at that. It lays it out a little more clearly. And then in the capital markets, the key thing is just, you know, getting the word out, closing that valuation gap, right? I mean, we just get to the level of the lowest valued company in our peer group. That's already a buck a share.
Wow.
that's just closing the gap with essentially the worst of our peer group.
Well, I'm happy to be sitting on my chunk, for full disclosure. I'm obviously a fan, and anything that moves up, I'm going to benefit from. But I think that anyone who's interested at all in the prospects of precious metals, like, this is one of those companies that I think you just take a chunk, you put it in your back pocket, and you come back to it in a year's time and see what happened. I think it's going to be a really interesting story.
Thank you, too. Thanks.
Thanks for your time, man. We're supposed to be a 20-minute chat, but there's too much good stuff, so we're a special extended version. That was great, Tim.
That's
really appreciate it.
A lot of fun. Awesome.
Well,
thanks.
Where are you off to next?
I have to go to Mali and then to Ghana, and probably back to Russia as well. There's a lot of money in Moscow, believe it or not.
Yeah, I believe it.
So talking with those guys, they have a lot of deep pockets, and I just, you know, not a lot of people go out there to talk to them. So if you do, you're already ahead of the curve.
Interesting. All right. Well, good luck in there, and we'll talk again in a few weeks.
Sounds good. Thanks,
man. Bye.